This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll get a glimpse into the horrendous conditions of long-term solitary confinement in the so-called supermax prisons of Ohio.
Four prisoners in solitary facing the death penalty are trying to get onto death row. Why? The conditions are better.
We'll talk with an activist and attorney about the recent rash of subpoenas issued by the FBI.
23 subpoenas have now been issued. The administration seems emboldened by their recent victory in Humanitarian Law Project v. Holder, which criminalized almost any kind of contact with organizations claimed to be foreign terrorist organizations.
Stay with us. There's a move afoot, Michael, to have what we're going to be seeing as a dual citizenship in different states.
Well, it's dual citizenship, but not in the sense of, Heidi, that you're a citizen of the United States and Armenia. It's not that kind of dual citizenship. What they're thinking of it is a really nasty, retrograde, antediluvian law, again, coming out of Arizona, having to do with immigration, coming out of Kansas, coming out of a number of states, of people who don't like the fact that an undocumented worker who has her child in the United States will be having a child that is a United States citizen. The law is very clear right now. The 14th Amendment, which came after the Civil War, is an amendment that said that any person born in the United States is a citizen of the United States. And of course, that law was passed in reaction to the infamous Dred Scott decision. The Dred Scott decision not only said that you can own somebody, but equally said that African Americans born here were not citizens of the United States.
It said that black people have no rights which white people are bound to observe.
So because of that, they passed the 14th Amendment. Since that time, anybody born in the United States is automatically a citizen of the United States.
Despite their parents' status.
Right. The parent status is irrelevant to whether or not they're a citizen. If they're born on American territory, American property in the United States, they are U.S. citizens.
So this would, in effect, create two kinds of citizens.
Well, we haven't seen the exact proposal. Now, the people who are the proponents trying to push this idea that you shouldn't become automatically a U.S. citizen if your parents are undocumented realize they can't change the 14th Amendment. That the 14th Amendment, while some people could argue about its exact meaning, that's going to be very hard to do. So what they want to try and do is create a series of court cases that begin to redefine the nature of citizenship. And they're going to do that by looking at various states, Arizona, Kansas, some other places, and they're going to pass a law that essentially sets up, as you said, dual types of citizenship, but less dual than one kind of citizen being if your parents were American citizens and then you're born here, and the other kind, a special kind of certificate, if your mother, I guess, in particular, was undocumented. And then you'll get a different kind of citizenship. And then, of course, when you get denied certain benefits in various states because of that, there'll be court litigation. And the hopes of the antediluvian, which I never knew what that word meant, but it means before the flood, implying something that's really retrograde. Anyway, the antediluvian proponents of this law are hoping that there will be court cases that eventually uphold the idea that undocumented workers do not have children who are born citizens of the United States.
One of the reasons purportedly for this is, I would assume, to stem the tide of people coming in and having children here. And as you mentioned before we aired, there's no proof.
There's no tide.
Right.
That people come here for that reason.
Right. The evidence is that that is not why people come to the United States. They come here for work. They come here for jobs. That is why they come here. They come here because their economies have been destroyed by the United States as well as by world capitalism, and they have to come into the United States to be able to support their families.
Yeah, but the function of this hysteria about the Hispanics pouring over our borders and taking our jobs is simply to divert people, and there are plenty of angry people out there. It's just like blaming all the problems on the Muslims and being against a mosque in Lower Manhattan. It's all BS. It's all a show, and they make a lot of fanfare out of it.
I mean, if we look at all this stuff, and I think it's at some point we should explore it more, Islamophobia, what's happening to Muslims, what's happening in the prosecutions, what's happening around immigration. We're seeing a country that's moving in a very nativist direction, is the best way to say it, in which if you don't have the skin color and the birth certificate that white people have, you're looked at with great suspicion.
Yeah, the irrationality is real scary. You know, after all, Hitler, who was a bit of a maniac, was able to convince enough people that the Jews were the problem in Germany to eventually take power. It's that kind of diversion and demagoguery that's going on here. Clear, rational, scientific voices are not being heard like they should.
Let's hope people stand up against this law and just say this is ridiculous. But, you know, there's a lot of bad sentiment in this country around immigration. It's the one area where when we cover it on our show, and I hear also some other liberal to left stations cover it, that they actually get their audience reactions to be somewhat mixed and riled up.
Yeah. And the truth is, and you can't repeat this enough, that the jobs that these Hispanics who come here and take are jobs that Americans will not take.
And that's, of course, what we brought on our last show when Jake Ratner and Elena Stein said, United Farm Workers put up a campaign for 2 months saying, you want a job? Come work with United Farm Workers.
Yeah, pick tomatoes.
And in 2 months, they only got two applications, and both of them were undocumented. So that's really a good illustration about what BS we're hearing when it comes to people taking away American jobs.
Listeners may recall that in 1994, Jamie and Gladys Scott, two sisters, were convicted of a 1993 crime on Christmas Eve of leading two men into ambush and robbing them of approximately $11. The sisters had accomplices, three teenage boys, who have served their sentences and got out a couple of years ago, I believe. The sisters have denied that they played any role in the crime, and they are serving double life sentences. The older sister has kidney failure, and we just found out the sisters are actually going to be released from their double life sentences on the condition that one sister give her kidney to the other one.
Now, that seems like a very, very strange condition. There's no way that condition is constitutional. I mean, how can your freedom depend on your
being an organ donor?
Right, exactly. It's completely crazy. Of course, it's Haley Barbour is the governor of Mississippi, and that's who apparently did this. I think if that sister refused when she came out to give it, she would still be freed.
Let me point out, for clarity's sake, that the idea of the kidney donation actually came from the sisters. But there was a big movement. Local churches, newspapers, the NAACP had been urging for a while that the Scott sisters be released. So this is a victory, and the sisters say that they would have donated the kidney anyway. But I think you're right. That could not be a lawful condition.
So we're glad finally there was some action here, but of course the outrage that two women are put in prison essentially for double life sentences for robbery of $11 in which no one was injured apparently.
I have another organ-related update on former Vice President Dick Cheney. You may have read that he has no pulse. His ventricle doesn't work. They've given him a heart pump that's attached to a 1.2-volt battery and told him he go out hunting again. So Cheney now has half a heart, although people have questioned whether he ever had a whole heart.
This was an increase in the heart, in the size of his heart.
Right, increase,
yeah.
Transplant.
And he's taking a medicine called, this is hard to make up, called warfarin. So good luck, Dick.
And actually they said when I read the article that what he's on now, this heart pump, will hold him for a while. They don't know how long. Eventually he'll need a heart transplant.
Yeah, we got any volunteers out there?
How old is he now?
69.
Nah, okay.
Michael, we interviewed Bill Quigley, legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, a few weeks ago about Haiti. Is there an update in the center's work?
Right. We particularly interviewed Bill about his visit with the center attorney to the camps in Haiti and about what was happening to women who, if they had to go to the bathroom at night, if they had to leave, walk around at night, that they were subject to a high number of rapes, of abuse, and that kind of thing. And there was a claim that the Haitian government and the UN and nobody was really doing enough here to protect women in the camps. As a result, a number of groups, including the center, filed a complaint with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. These groups just won a victory on behalf of the Haitian women, in which the Haitian government has ordered to increase the protection of women and girls in the internal displacement camps and to effectively prosecute rape complaints. The exact order includes medical and psychological treatment for victims of sexual violence in 22 internal displacement camps, security improvements in the camps, lighting, better security patrols, and more women officers, training for police and prosecutors on responding to gender-based violence, creating special units in the investigative police office to investigate the rapes, and continues along those lines. Now, let's hope that the Haitian government takes its responsibilities seriously. The Inter-American Commission doesn't really have enforcement powers. It can go to the court, though, the Inter-American Court, if the Haitian government doesn't begin seriously addressing the gender-based violence that's going on in the 22 internal displacement camps in Haiti. It's a big victory, but let's just see how it's implemented.
It's a victory, but then that whole process is so time-consuming of monitoring and then going through the court since they don't have enforcement capability.
Right. It's just another, what's the way to say this? It's imagine a scale of justice, and you at least you keep putting weights on the scale in the hope that someday it'll outbalance injustice. And so this is essentially a weight on the scale of justice.
In an Ohio supermax prison, four inmates facing execution are confined to permanent restrictive solitary confinement. They're on a hunger strike, bringing attention to their requests to simply be placed on death row. What's the difference? Death row isn't as restrictive as permanent solitary confinement. Jules Lobel, vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, explains in detail the differences of regular prison, death row, and solitary confinement conditions. Working on behalf of the prisoners, Jules says that long-term and essentially permanent and very harsh solitary confinement amounts to both cruel and unusual punishment that violates the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. The state of Ohio has decided to keep those four in solitary confinement permanently. But it's not only in Ohio. Such solitary confinement is becoming a national problem, particularly with people convicted of terrorism-related offenses, including material aid to terrorism. Jules Lobel joins us today. Welcome, Jules, to Law and Disorder.
Good to be with you, folks.
We've talked a lot on this program about confinement conditions and torture, and you're involved in a case involving an Ohio supermax prison in which four inmates who are facing execution are actually confined to permanent solitary confinement. Can you tell us about the case?
On Monday, these four prisoners who are facing permanent solitary confinement, they've been confined this way for 17 years, decided to go on a hunger strike.
What is meant by solitary confinement?
Well, in this case, they are in cells which are probably no bigger than a parking spot in New York City. And they're confined 23 hours a day, and some days 24 hours. They're allowed out 5 hours a week, 1 hour each time. For the 23 hours a day, they're in their cell alone. The cell doesn't have bars like the typical cell that you might see on television or in the movies. It's a solid steel door, and they actually, the prison officials actually put strips on all the sides of the door and then the bottom and the top of it to prevent any sound or anything from getting out.
I find just your description, I mean, I'm slightly claustrophobic, but it sounds absolutely horrible. I mean, it just sounds, even the strips on the door, you can't even look underneath to get fresh air or whatever air there is.
There's a little window which goes to the outside, but it's not openable, you know, so you get no fresh air. These folks have been locked in this situation for 17 years. It's because they were the leaders of a prison rebellion in Lucasville, Ohio, in a maximum security prison, demanding better conditions. And several of them actually negotiated the end to that rebellion. But in that rebellion, a guard and a number of inmates were killed. And even though the agreement that they negotiated promised no retaliation, what they claim, and Staunton Wind, who's done a lot of work and has written a book on it, backs up their claims that they were really prosecuted for the murder of the guard and the other prisoners because they were chosen, because they were the leaders of the rebellion and not because they had anything to do with it.
They've gotten the death penalty because of that prison altercation, is that it?
Right. Because of that, they were given the death penalty and they're facing execution. But unlike all other prisoners on death row in facing execution in Ohio who are put in on death row, these four prisoners have been isolated and kept in the supermax on the most restrictive level for the last 12 years. Before that, they were in solitary confinement in another prison.
Jules, can you talk a bit about the issue of discretion on the part of prison officials in determining where the inmates are housed?
Well, the case we brought a number of years ago that the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU jointly brought.
I saw Jules argue in the Supreme Court.
Which we argued in the Supreme Court.
We being Jules.
Claim that the prison officials claim that they have absolute discretion, that they could put anybody in this prison that they wanted for whatever reason. And in fact, they were putting sort of lower-level drug offenses, you know, people who had some minor amount of marijuana, they were putting in this prison because after the prison riot, they built a prison, a supermax prison, with 500 cells. And they had nowhere near 500 people who, under any conceivable criteria, would warrant this kind of confinement. So they just started putting anybody they wanted in there. And we won on that with the court holding that you have to give these people some kind of due process proceeding. And including that, they have to give them annual reviews. So they can't just put them in the supermax and warehouse them there and give them no review. The problem in this case, which will probably be the problem in Guantanamo, because they're using the same formula. The Obama administration has come up with the same formula, which is that we'll give the folks we're detaining in Guantanamo some kind of annual review. What's happened to these four people is that every year they go to their annual review, they say, well, your behavior's been good, you don't have any prison infractions, you've taken your, you know, whatever programs we can offer you here, GED or whatever, but because of your original offense, we're going to keep you here. And in fact, in one of these reviews, the prison official said, we're going to keep you here forever. There's nothing you could do to get out. So what's the point of the review?
Right.
Go to the review and they say, well, because of your original offense, namely involvement in this riot and the crime for which you got the death penalty, we're going to keep you there forever. And my hunch is that's what's going to happen with some of the prisoners, at least in Guantanamo.
Go back to the hunger strike, Jules. What's going on? Because that's where we started this.
Right. What these prisoners are demanding, their basic demand, which is quite unbelievable in a way, is that they want to get put into death row.
Yeah.
They want to get placed with all the other prisoners facing execution on death row, which would give them a couple of things. One is they'd have some human contact. They have no contact visits with their family, with, you know, friends. They can't touch another human being. People on death row do have contact visits, at least some kind of contact visits. The people on death row are not put in for 23 hours a day in this solitary lockup. They could eat meals with other prisoners. They can sometimes recreate with other prisoners. And so they want that. And third, on death row, they have much more access to legal materials and legal research, which is critical for their cases and for their challenges to their death sentences, and they want that. What kind of empowerment do these prisoners have? What can they do to protest? They're totally isolated from the outside world, totally isolated from each other. So the only thing they said they could do is, in a sense, deprive themselves of a basic human need, namely food. And so they're refusing to eat. And they are committed to doing this, you know, until they get their demand. It's possible that this could repeat what happened in the Irish hunger strike, is that they'll let these folks die.
Yeah, or in Guantanamo, where they were force-fed.
Yeah, that's probably what they'll wind up doing.
Jules, could you talk for a minute about the psychological impact of such confinement? I've read that experts say that 3 months in solitary is enough to cause severe psychological damage?
In the 1890s, the Supreme Court held that any kind of prolonged solitary confinement can cause serious mental harm. And when we litigated this case in the Supreme Court, the Ohio case in the Supreme Court, just 5 years ago, there was a brief signed by many prominent psychologists who said, you know, even a few months in a supermax or in this kind of solitary confinement can cause serious harm. When you go to these prisons, if you look into some of the cells, you see people, men pacing back and forth and back and forth. You know, if you just think of yourself in a small contained cell 23 hours a day with no human contact whatsoever for years and years and years, it's amazing that these four guys haven't gone crazy before this. There's a fifth defendant who has been declared mentally ill. And if you can get a psychologist to declare you mentally ill, they'll transfer you out of the supermax.
Jules, the United States has signed the Treaty Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel and Inhuman Treatment. So that's the law of the land. Why isn't what's happening to not only these four men, but I understand there's upward of 25,000 people in America who are in solitary confinement. Why isn't there some kind of claim made that this amounts to torture?
Well, there is, and it's not only are there 25,000 people confined in supermax, but there's a growing number of people among those 25,000 who are in supermaxes for years and years and years. In Angola, in the prison in Louisiana, the Louisiana State Penitentiary, which is called Angola, there are three prisoners. One was recently released, but two of whom have been in solitary confinement for almost 40 years. You know, the psychological harm is unbelievable with those folks, and a district court judge, a federal district court judge 3 years ago, held that this could possibly be cruel and inhuman treatment or torture. They are going to apparently have a trial on that issue this coming year. In Florence, in the federal penitentiary, there are dozens of people who've been sent there essentially again for their whole sentence. And I think it's a growing trend.
But contrast with other countries. Aren't we one of the only countries that uses this as a form of punishment?
Well, Europe has started using this for certain convicted terrorists. But the European Court of Human Rights has held that in certain cases, this type of solitary confinement can be torture or cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment. And in Europe, it's used very, very infrequently. You know, I mean, you might have a couple of people in each country who are put into this kind of condition, and they are usually given many, many more privileges than these folks in the supermax are able to get. You know, that it's a way of isolating people, but not to the extreme that you see in the United States. But in Europe, the European Court has held that this can constitute torture. In the United States, I think there's a general tendency against recognizing psychological harm. So, for example, the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which really is a close-the-door-on-prisoner claims act, says that you cannot get damages for psychological injury unless there's been an explicit physical injury. So, for example, even what happened in Abu Ghraib might not be actionable in the United States because if there was no direct physical harm that you can show. And I think that's just the tendency in the United States to not recognize the serious psychological harm that comes from some of these prison practices.
How does Ohio Supermax compare with other such facilities in this country?
The Ohio Supermax was quite a restrictive one to begin with. Because of our lawsuit, it has become less restrictive for many prisoners, although not these four prisoners, not the guys on the hunger strike. But for many others, it's become much less restrictive. In the last 20 years, there's been a tremendous growth of these supermaxes, but there's now been a rethinking in at least some states. because it is extremely costly. And again, the number of people who really could legitimately even be said to warrant this, and I think I've made clear, I don't think anybody warrants this kind of treatment because it's torture. But even among prison administrators, there's a recognition that if you build a 500-person Supermax, you're going to fill it. And you're going to fill it with people who, even under their own criteria, don't warrant this. So I think there's been some reaction against these Supermaxes in the country now, in the last few years.
Jules, if we and our listeners want to voice a protest against this torture and come to the support of these four prisoners in the Ohio Supermax, is there a website or persons or
there
phone numbers
website.
That we can contact?
There is a website. If you put in, I don't have the website, the actual website in front of me, but if you put in Ohio hunger strikers, you'll get to the website, and there is some various letters of support and things like that. There has been a letter of support, which I think is posted on the website, signed by Noam Chomsky and other prominent people, and some less than prominent people like myself who signed it.
You signed it, Jules?
We're looking for more signatures. We're looking for all kind, whatever media and publicity we can get about this situation.
Ohio Hunger Strikers on the web.
I just want to thank you for both litigating the Supermax case, for continuing your amazing, remarkable interest in prisons, and for really bringing attention to the incredible plight of these four men.
By the way, also, Staunton Lind has a wonderful interview on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, which is posted on their website, all about this situation.
Good. Give our best to Staunton.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Jules.
Thanks, Jules.
Thank you, Jules.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Listeners know, last September, in a nationally coordinated raid, the FBI targeted anti-war and Palestinian solidarity activists, raided their homes, and subpoenaed them to appear before a grand jury. The 13 people, all of whom were critical of U.S. foreign policy, later withdrew and asserted their right to remain silent. But in early December of 2010, subpoenas were reissued against four of those targeted in the raids. Three women in Minneapolis, Tracy Malm, Ann Pham, and Sarah Martin, were sent reactivated subpoenas by Fitzgerald's office with new grand jury dates. We're joined by Chicago-based journalist and activist Maureen Murphy, who also received a new subpoena. Maureen is managing editor at the website Electronic Intifada, though the site is not being targeted in the FBI probe. In a statement, the Electronic Intifada said, quote, "Although the Electronic Intifada itself has not been a target, we consider the grand jury investigation and all the subpoenas to be part of a broad attack on the anti-war and Palestinian solidarity movements and a threat to all of our rights." Maureen, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Maureen, it seems that this subpoena for you to come in front of a grand jury is an attack on the anti-war movement and the Palestinian solidarity movements. What's your take on this? Why is this happening?
Well, I'm not entirely sure why it's happening. We do know that no crime has been identified, and more people are being subpoenaed to appear before a federal grand jury, and the numbers keep on rising each week, it seems. And there's no clear reason for us to be investigated as far as we can see. For example, there's nothing written on my subpoena that says I need to bring any documents or anything. So we believe that the government is subpoenaing us so we come before a grand jury and name names and tell them how we organize so they can further disrupt our movement.
Let's back up for a second, Maureen. Tell us what you got from the government. You got a subpoena. What is it? What does it ask you to do?
Well, I'm one of 23 activists now who have gotten the knock on the door, and on September 24th, a federal task force invaded the homes of several anti-war and solidarity and labor organizers in the Midwest. So all of us now, 23 of us, have received subpoenas to appear before a federal grand jury in Chicago as part of what the government calls an investigation into material support for terrorism.
Now, are you free to share with us what your subpoena asks you to testify about?
My subpoena says nothing except to just show up. So that's why I think that this is really a fishing expedition. You know, when they raided people's homes, they didn't even seem to know what they were looking for. For example, in one individual's home, they just basically took everything with the word Palestine on it. And in another home, they were going through the possessions of a couple's child, stealing his high school poetry notebooks and going through his T-shirts and questioning whether any of his T-shirts should have been taken in as evidence. So it's really outrageous, and it's outrageous that the government has clearly expended a lot of resources on an investigation into people who have always worked publicly to advocate for a more just U.S. policy. On the first day of the raids, the FBI acknowledged that we serve no threat to the American public, and the only thing that has been harmed so far is the rights of us all to dissent and to organize to peacefully change U.S. policy.
Maureen, let me make this clear. Were you one of the individuals who was served in September?
No, I was visited by the FBI on December 21st.
And was your home searched?
No, they didn't come into my home.
They just served the subpoena.
Exactly.
What happens next? You have a day to appear?
Yeah, so several of us are scheduled to appear before a grand jury in Chicago on January 25th. So a national committee that has formed around the raids and subpoenas is calling for a day of action on January 25th. So already I've heard that more than 32 cities across the United States have committed to organizing actions in front of federal buildings and FBI headquarters to make it clear that this is not just about 23 people, but this is about an entire movement and entire social justice communities who understand that it could have been any one of us who were raided on the 24th, and it can be any one of us who can expect to be to receive a knock on the door from the FBI and to be brought in for this fishing expedition. And so we have to make it clear that there is a broad movement that is going to stand up for our rights, and an attack on one is an attack on us all.
Maureen, do you plan to resist? Are you going to exercise non-cooperation?
I have already stated that I'm not going to testify, even though it means I risk being jailed for contempt of court for the life of the grand jury.
You get the subpoena. They ask you to come to the grand jury. You can consult your lawyer, but of course you can't bring your lawyer into the grand jury room. And then you can assert the Fifth Amendment. And then they have to give you an immunity against prosecution. And you haven't been to the stage yet of asserting the Fifth Amendment, is that right?
That's correct. My understanding is that you have this first date, and then that's when you make your intention clear, whether you intend to testify or not. And then it's after that that they impose on you what is called limited immunity. And that really means that they give you the choice of informing the government about the activities of other activists, whether those activists are here in the United States or in places that some of us have traveled to, like Palestine and Colombia, or going straight to jail. And I want to make clear that one of the reasons that I am not testifying is that I believe that they want us to name the names of people that we've met in these places where we've gone to learn about the impact of U.S. foreign policy. So I've done Palestine solidarity work, and I've traveled throughout the West Bank and throughout the Middle East. And I know that for Palestinian human rights activists to be singled out and to be named is basically a guaranteed jail sentence or worse. And I have no intention in playing any role in that.
But it seems to me, Maureen, that it's a win-win situation for this government, because if they can't get you to testify and name names and victimize people, then they can put you away. And the service that you and Ali perform in getting out the electronic intifada is a great one. It's something that we've all relied on for years. We've had Ali on our show. We made a movie about the one-state solution in Palestine with him. And this is a way to try to put movement activists on ice for doing nothing other than exercising their First Amendment and reporting the news.
True. And I want to make clear that there's no reason to believe that I have been subpoenaed because of my work with the Electronic Intifada. I am the managing editor of the website, but I'm one of several organizers with the Palestine Solidarity Group in Chicago who have been subpoenaed. So I don't want people to come to the conclusion that EI is under investigation or that I'm subpoenaed because of my work with the publication. But there is a long history of the U.S. government attempting to criminalize the Palestine support movement in the United States. And we've seen that, you know, since 1967 when Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and there was a wave of immigration of Palestinians to the United States. And once they got here, many of them tried to peacefully organize to educate Americans about the U.S. funding of the Israeli occupation. And many of them were deported, and the most famous case was that of the LA-8, who were subjected to 20 years of deportation proceedings because they basically distributed pamphlets.
Yes, actually, I'm familiar with the New York, with the LA-8 particularly, because I remember when they were arrested, and then our office and a few other lawyers on the West Coast represented them for 20 years. I just want to get, for you to give the dates, the next thing that's going to happen in these cases, and then the website people can go to find out more information, Maureen.
The National Day of Action that's been scheduled around the court date of January 25th is when we are calling on people to come out and show public support for us and show that people are going to stand up for their rights and their right to free speech and to organize. More information can be found at stopfbi.net. And we're also calling on supporters to call President Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder and U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald to make it clear that people aren't going to stand for this attack on our rights.
Thank you, Maureen. We really appreciate it. And good luck with this. And your courageous stand is really admired by all of us who've been living with grand juries, really, since my whole life as a political progressive lawyer.
Thanks, Maureen.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're also joined by regular guest attorney Michael Deutsch with the People's Law Office in Chicago, who is working with the Defense Committee.
We'd like to apologize for some erratic sound quality in this interview. We did call Michael Deutsch several times and did the best we could. Michael, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
This past December, we had what seems to be a second wave of subpoenas following the rash that occurred in September. Can you give us a brief summary of what happened?
Yeah, towards the end of December, the FBI went out with a stack of subpoenas and wound up subpoenaing 9 additional people in the Chicago area, which then makes 23. 14 had been subpoenaed right after the raids in the end of September. And these people who are subpoenaed are all people who are active in Palestinian support work. Either they're involved with a group called the Arab American Action Network, AAAN, or they're part of a group called the Palestinian Support Group. Some of them have made trips to the Middle East. Others have been just active in the Chicago area and educating people about the situation in Israel-Palestine.
And are the subpoenas asking for specific documents, or are they, do you think, sort of a general fishing expedition?
Well, unlike the first series of subpoenas, which did ask for documents to be produced, these subpoenas only talk about coming to testify. And it seems to me what's going on now, the first group, it seemed, were people who were directly related to the searches and to, in some way, related to this Freedom Road socialist organization. This next wave of subpoenas are people who are not necessarily related to that organization, but are people who they're trying to gather information from. So it's particularly a fishing expedition in terms of gathering information about people's political work and associations.
Michael, I don't understand. You mean to say someone gets a subpoena that doesn't even mention a criminal law they're investigating, that they don't?
No.
They just say, like, Michael Deutsch, report to the grand jury to testify, and it doesn't say what about?
No, it does not say what it's about. It just says you're subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury January 25th. It doesn't even say the statute which they're investigating.
Have you had any experience in your life with a subpoena like that?
No, I haven't had experience with that. And of course, I've never, in all my experience, seen so many people subpoenaed to a grand jury, I mean, in a political situation. So it really looks to me like they're just relying on any type of relationship to the Palestinian solidarity movement to subpoena people to a grand jury, people who went on trips, people who went to demonstrations, people who are active in community work. So it's a very strange development, but ominous nonetheless.
Michael, I'm curious about the Midwest region. Now, do you think we're seeing so many subpoenas in this area because of the presence of joint terrorism task forces there? Do you have any explanation?
I don't think it's related to the fact that there's a joint terrorist task force here, because there's one in New York and probably one in other places. I think it's because a lot of the Palestine support work has gone on in Chicago and based in Chicago. And I would say that the FBI has been around somewhat in New York and in the Bay Area trying to talk to people as well. So the subpoenas may extend to other areas, but because one of the main targets of their investigation is the executive director of the AAAN, the Arab American Action Network, Hatem Abodaya, they're focusing on him and people who work with him or who are part of organizations that he's been part of, and that's what this last wave of subpoenas is really focused on.
Michael, has anything actually happened yet? You have the 23 subpoenas. You know, we've been through this before on the show. People get the right to at least claim privilege against self-incrimination, the Fifth Amendment. They then get immunity. Have we gone to any stage with any of it?
No, it's really interesting. What happened is originally 14 people were subpoenaed, and each one, through their lawyers, said that they were not going to voluntarily come in and they would assert their Fifth Amendment right. And the government backed off at that point and said, well, we're not going to give you immunity, and they kind of postpone this. And then they picked three of the people who were activists in Minnesota, and they said they wanted to talk to them. And rather than talk to them, their lawyers went in to talk to them, and two of the lawyers have gone in, one is still waiting. And what they did was a very strange thing. When the lawyer came in, they said, well, we want your client to cooperate with us, and we're going to show you some of the evidence that we have against your client. And they did some kind of dog and pony show about it, and then said, we want your client now to come in and proffer to us. In those two cases, the lawyer got back to them and said, no, our client's not willing to come in and proffer to them.
It's the strangest thing I've ever heard, but go ahead.
And they haven't said, now we're going to enforce a subpoena. They've said, well, we'll get back to you when we decide what we're going to do. So far, even though there's been 23 people subpoenaed, no one has been given immunity, so no one has yet been coerced to either make the decision to testify under coercion or be held in contempt. So we're waiting to see what they're going to do with this. There's 23 people lined up trying to figure out what the next step of the government is.
Right, what the next step of the government, their lives, and what's happening in that whole Palestinian community and movement.
Exactly. It's
shocking,
exactly.
Really.
Yeah, yeah. And what I think, although I don't know for sure, is this first group of people were more targets. So they seemed reluctant to give them immunity without having them proffer to them, which, you know, that's what happens in a regular...
Talk about what it means, proffer.
Right.
So what a proffer means is essentially you go in there and you're trying to avoid being indicted, and the government wants to know what you know, and in return for you, if you have information they want, in return for becoming a government witness, they agree not to indict you. So this is a process that happens in a regular criminal case. And the government, these prosecutors that are involved in this case, don't seem to have an understanding what they're dealing with. You know, they're dealing with people who are political people, who are activists, who believe the grand jury is a tool of repression, and they're not going to cooperate with the grand jury, and they're not going to testify before a grand jury or cooperate with the U.S. attorney.
It seems to me at least possible that this whole enterprise could have originated at the highest levels of government, not only in the United States, but also in Israel. Do you have those sorts of suspicions?
Well, I definitely think that this whole FBI raid and this whole material support prosecution that's looming would not have happened unless the main justice in Washington was involved. And I also believe that the Israelis are involved as well. I believe that the Israeli security apparatus is involved in supplying information to the U.S. government. There were several trips made to the Middle East by Palestinian activists. We believe their trips were monitored by the Israeli secret police. And based on my experience with the U.S. and Israelis in a prior case, I know they work closely on these types of political prosecutions. I think the go-ahead does come from Washington, and I do think the Israeli security apparatus is definitely involved in cooperating with this.
Michael, what are you telling people like our audience that they can do to help out here?
Well, right now, as we're kind of in a limbo stage, but what I'm asking people to do is to write to Patrick Fitzgerald, the United States attorney here, who's very well known as a so-called terrorism fighter, to withdraw these grand jury subpoenas and stop this persecution of the political activists who are under subpoena, and to return all the property that was seized, and to end their attack on people who are doing political work, protected political work, on behalf of solidarity with Palestine or Colombia. There's no evidence here in anything we've seen of any type of terrorism activity, any type of violence, any type of weapons, safe houses, communication of that type. We're dealing essentially with advocacy and associations. Despite Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project, we believe that it's totally a violation of the First Amendment and a violation of people's political rights that's going on here. One of the things I would mention is that one of the U.S. attorneys said, oh, you know, these Freedom Road people are Marxist-Leninists. They call each other comrade, and they want to overthrow the U.S. government. So this is kind of the underlying tenor of their whole prosecution, is to go after people and this organization because of their political ideology.
Comrade Deutsch, I really... anyway, that is a remarkable story, Michael. I mean, that just shows we're in another period. I mean, we don't even understand what's going on.
You know, we've been through all this grand jury stuff and this attacks, but I've never seen something that's so ideological on its face and so broad. I mean, we're talking about, you know, 23 people. I'm foreseeing a major conspiracy indictment using the material support law and maybe even RICO, which really involves solidarity work with Colombia, Palestine, Philippines, Nepal, who knows?
Amazing. It looks like it's just out to wipe out an organization that was
doing... Exactly. And people who are, you know, somehow even not even in the organization, but associated with them or agree with some of their political positions.
Well, if there's any glimmer of hope, it would seem that the wide extent of this is drawing other activists together to mobilize against it, so that because of the breadth of this, it's garnering more public support.
Yeah, and that is good that there's been a lot of support in different communities and different stratas of society. What will happen when the indictments come down and, you know, the government starts talking about terrorism and terrorist organizations, it remains to be seen in terms of, you know, what the support will be.
Well, Michael Deutsch from the People's Law Office, you know, you kicked some butt when you were the head of the legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights here in New York, and you're doing it out in Chicago now. And we're really grateful for your excellent political work and grateful for your being on Law and Disorder.
Michael, if people want to catch up on where things are there, is there a website that people should go to?
There is a website. It's called StopFBI.net, and there'll be all the updates on the subpoenas and, you know, demonstrations and call-ins. So that's the best way to get the most recent information.
We'll put a link on our website.
Okay, great.
Perfect.
Thanks for your
Thank
great
you.
Work.
Thanks,
and
Mike.
We're sorry about the connection.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, great. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, take care, guys.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now, you should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law and Disorder to your friends through Facebook.
Listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.